Welcome to Morning Report Top Stories, a selection of news from Radio New Zealand National's Morning News Programme.
National MP Sam Uffendale has been stood down from the party's caucus while an investigation is done into further allegations of bullying raised by RNZ. A woman who flattered with the Tauranga MP at university in 2003 says Mr Uffendale was an aggressive bully who once pounded on her bedroom door screaming obscenities until she fled through her window. In a statement issued late last night, Mr Uffendale denied claims he engaged in intimidatory or bullying behaviour, but said there was a falling out between flatmates. The allegations follow revelations that Mr Uffendale, as a teenager, beat up a younger boy at Auckland's prestigious King's College boarding school and was asked to leave. The MP yesterday described himself as a 16-year-old thug, but said he was now a changed person. RNZ has spoken to his former flatmate and her father. They did not want to be named.
I met Sam at university, my first year of university at Otago. We were in the same hall of residence and became part of the same friends group there, and ended up going flatting with him. It was him and four others in our second year of university.
And your experience flatting with him was something that worried you. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, it was definitely a traumatising event. Obviously, the freedom of being out of the hall of residence without, you know, the rules and authority to answer to there went to his head, and it was, you know, excessive drinking and drugs, and which resulted in a lot of damage to the flat physically, and then also bullying, verbal, emotional bullying to myself, to the point where it all kind of culminated one evening where I was locked in my bedroom because I feared for my safety. And he was smashing on my door and yelling obscenities and, you know, basically telling me to get out and hit the road, fatty, and swearing. And I ended up climbing out of my bedroom window and running to a friend's house to stay the night because I feared for my safety. I was scared.
If I bring your father in now, you were called, she called you to come and get her the next day, and you spoke to Sam Uffendale, is that right?
That's right. My daughter rang me, rang my wife and I. She was seriously upset and traumatised. I went to Dunedin the next day to help her get out of the flat immediately, and I spoke to Mr Uffendale and his other flatmates at the time. The flat itself was completely trashed. There wasn't a stick of furniture left. There was no crockery left. There were no handles left on anything. It had all been broken. And I gave the three of them a very serious peace of mind, but my daughter wasn't in any position to deal with this in a legal way, and we just took her out. She just went out of there and went into another place and set about recovering from this.
Was that night that you described the only time you felt unsafe?
No. Whenever he, you know, went out or you know, partied at home, there was definitely, I was intimidated by his demeanour, his actions. He was verbally aggressive. He was aggressive physically in the sense of breaking and smashing things. Yeah, it was not an isolated incident. It was just the straw that broke the camel's back.
Some might hear of student partying days and wonder if this was, you know, out of control students in Dunedin, which isn't that uncommon, But you're saying this was much more than that.
Yes, this was intimidation. This was bullying. I didn't feel safe. No, I don't think that this can just be written off as a student behaviour, as a typical student behaviour. I don't think that justifies those actions.
So your father came down that day, and you mentioned, was there any thought of taking this to, say, the student authorities or taking it on further?
Yes, my father wanted to speak to the proctor, but I was scared. Looking back now, yes, I probably should have said something, but I wanted to remove myself from the situation, I felt scared. I didn't want to be any more involved in it.
Has Sam Uffendale reached out at any point to apologise or talk to you about what happened?
No, I mean, I would see him around campus or out, and I would avoid him. I was, my stomach would absolutely flip and drop if I saw him. And I think out one night he had approached me and tried to, brush over the situation. No apologies, but just almost gloss over that it had happened. No, I mean, to be honest, it was so long ago that I can't remember the timelines exactly for that. But since then, no contact whatsoever.
And what has prompted you to take the step to speak out?
Hearing about this young victim of boarding school, I think that it's, again, very easy to say, he was 16, he's a child, he didn't know what he was doing, there shouldn't be repercussions for his actions when he was that young. But I think this is relevant. It shows his character, it shows a pattern. Reading, listening to his maiden speech in Parliament, he talks about lack of accountability and a sense of impunity. I think that's so hypocritical for him to say that and be in a position of power.
And if I could ask you, Father, too, you obviously very upset about the way you had to come down and get your daughter. What would you say to Sam Uffendale now?
I said as much to Sam at the time that I think he needs to take responsibility for his actions. This guy's got... It was clear at the time that he had real issues, real problems with this. He was out of control, and I really think he needs to front up, take responsibility.
Would you like to speak to him now about this?
If he wanted to offer my daughter an apology, I think people are always open to receiving apologies and would assess the genuineness of that when it's given. But frankly, in this circumstance, with this amount of publicity around it, an apology at this time is obviously well after the event and somewhat meaningless.
Now, late last night, National leader Christopher Luxon released this statement. Tauranga MP Sam Uffendale has been stood down from the National Party caucus pending an investigation into further allegations about his past behaviour. The statement went on to say, quote, "This evening, my office became aware of very concerning accusations made to RNZ about behaviour shown by Mr Uffendale. Mr Uffendale disputes the allegations, and in the interests of natural justice, an independent investigation will now be undertaken to determine the facts. While this process is underway, Mr Uffendale will be stood down from caucus. The investigation will be conducted by Maria Dew QC, and I expect it to take 2 weeks. The statement went on to say, however, as these allegations have only come to me within the last few hours, the finer details of the investigation, including the terms of reference, are yet to be confirmed and will be finalised over the next couple of days.
Sam Uffendale has also responded, saying when he was a student at Otago, he enjoyed a student lifestyle, which included drinking and at times smoking marijuana. In the second year, he says, a number of flatmates fell out and two of the flatmates left midway through the year. He rejects any accusation that he was engaged in behaviour that was bullying or intimidating of people. He says it simply did not happen. Mr Uffendale says that while there is an investigation into these accusations, he will not now make further comment. But we will be speaking to Christopher Luxon, the National Party leader, after 7:30 this morning, and we'll also look at the political analysis of all this with Jane Patterson, our political editor, after 8 o'clock.
A top United States diplomat says New Zealand could eventually become a member of the AUKUS Defence Alliance, talking up this country's strategic importance at the end of a week-long tour around the Pacific. US Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman met Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern yesterday and described relations between the countries as, quote, incredibly valuable. I asked her if defence ties could become closer given China's increased interest in the Pacific, and in particular, whether there was potential for New Zealand to join the AUKUS security pact between the US, UK and Australia.
Well, I think in the first instance, that project is focused on nuclear-powered submarines, and that's taking all of the energy of the three partners because it's a massive project. We've always said that going forward, as we look at other emerging technologies and what that may mean for everyone's security in the world, that there may be scope for others to join. So certainly if that time comes, New Zealand is a country with whom we would have conversation.
Yes, New Zealand is improving its capability in the Pacific region with the P-8 Poseidon surveillance aircraft, which I think do have anti-submarine technology. At that point, which those planes come on board, do you see an increased role between the two countries potentially in the Pacific?
Of course, we will continue to see where we can strengthen that partnership. New Zealand has to make its own decisions about its defense budget, about the capabilities that it needs. But I must say, I've just come from visiting Samoa, Tonga, Solomon Islands. New Zealand is a critical partner in the Blue Pacific. In fact, there is a new initiative, Partners in the Blue Pacific, of which New Zealand is part, to try to really organize and coordinate our efforts among the Pacific Islands, listening to them, building on shared priorities.
How concerned is the US by the, I guess what some would argue, an increased presence and competition from China in the Pacific region? In particular, the Solomon Islands has been this flashpoint about the potential for a military base there. How concerned is the US about that?
Well, I think the Pacific Island Forum has made clear that it's very critical that we are all cognizant of the security and the sovereignty of each of the Pacific Islands. And the, my understanding, actually, from the Prime Minister himself of Solomon Islands, he has assured his colleagues in the PIF that there will not be a permanent military base built by the Chinese. But that said, you know, what I think is really important is the United States is not asking countries to choose between the United States and China, but we are asking that the rules-based international order, which was created at the end of World War II, a war that we were remembering in the very solemn events in Solomon Islands on Sunday, that rules-based international order, which helped China to rise to the strong country that it is today, that same order be available to, for every other country to rise and to develop, and that no country should decide another country's political future. So I think it's very important that we are present in support of the priorities of Pacific Islands. New Zealand has always been in that position and is part of the PIF, Australia as well. We'll continue to watch the developments in the Solomon Islands very closely, and the Prime Minister and I had a very direct a conversation about our concerns.
Was there a discussion about the tensions in Taiwan? And I wonder if you had seen the comments from former New Zealand Prime Minister John Key, in which he criticised Nancy Pelosi for going there, calling it reckless. What is the view of the United States on government, and I say the executive branch, the White House, if you like, on Nancy Pelosi's visit? Was it reckless, as John Key suggested?
Well, as the president said, that was her decision. You know, we are not a parliamentary system. We have co-equal branches of government. And that means that the United States Congress gets to make its own decisions. The president cannot tell a member of Congress where to travel or not travel or what to do. They are a co-equal branch of our government. So the decision was entirely hers. And let me say, whether you agree with her decision or you disagree with her decision, the fact is the response by the People's Republic of China has been completely disproportionate to a member of Congress visiting. Many members of Congress have visited Taiwan in the past. U.S. policy toward Taiwan has not changed. That policy is decided by the executive branch. We have our one China policy. We do not support the independence of Taiwan. And that policy has not changed. So I think that the way that the PRC has reacted is very disproportionate, is escalatory. Taiwan is not escalating. The United States is not escalating. No one else is, except the People's Republic of China. And I think we all would rather see side take unilateral action to change the status quo of the Taiwan Straits. And I hope everyone is saying exactly that to China.
Mm. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern recently spoke on the issue of international conflict and warned against black and white approaches to conflict, and in particular this idea of democracy versus autocracies. Does the US see the struggles in the world at the moment between arguably the West and Russia and China as that, between democracies and autocracies?
Well, I certainly think that we are all concerned when there are leaders who believe that they can weaponize food security, as I believe Vladimir Putin has done. When we see leaders use economic coercion to try to bend a country's to their will, as we saw in Australia by the PRC and in Little Lithuania. So I think we are concerned when countries decide they're going to play by their rules and not by the international rules-based order. And, of course, the United States, as well as New Zealand, believe in a certain set of values, that people have a right to be heard, that people have a right to organize, that freedom of the press and freedom of religion is important, that people get to make their own choice about the political future of their country. And when those values are confronted, it takes away people's rights, humanity, dignity, and undermines the respect for our citizens to have a say in their future.
And that is the US Deputy Secretary of State, Wendy Sherman, who was visiting Wellington yesterday.
87 people have died in their homes from COVID-19 since March. Public health experts are calling for their deaths to be investigated. This figure means that on average, 4 people a week have been dying from the virus in their homes since Omicron hit. But little is known about who they are or how this has happened. Here's investigative journalist Anusha Bradley.
The official figures obtained by RNZ show nearly all who have died at home are over the age of 60. Just under half were boosted, a quarter fully vaccinated, but another quarter were not. Māori account for 18% and Pacifica 19%, with over half classified as European or other. In all cases, COVID is listed as the underlying or contributory cause of death, but Te Whatu Ora did not respond to questions about the circumstances of their death or the kind of contact they had with the health system. In a statement, it says some may have been under palliative care or had significant pre-existing conditions, while some may have chosen to stay at home or opted out of hospital care. Otago University epidemiologist Michael Baker says it's important to know more.
It's clearly very different if someone dies alone at home and is otherwise well and hasn't accessed care when it could have made a difference. We also want to know if people are accessing and using antivirals. And it does matter where people are dying and what care they had leading up to their death from COVID-19 infection, and it helps us say, are there things we could have done to avoid those deaths?
The chair of the Pacifica GP Network, Api Talemaitonga, says the figures are surprising, and given previous experiences, more analysis is needed into why so many Pacifica are dying from COVID at home.
In general, this is a population that, yes, interacts with healthcare, but as we know from areas like cancer diagnosis and screening, they interact late with healthcare, so they have worse outcomes.
Dr. Talemaitonga says many of his patients in South Auckland are not aware of antivirals or that they're eligible for them. The president of the College of GPs, Samantha Merton, says about a third of all deaths occur at home or at a hospice, so 87 COVID deaths is not too surprising. But she says it's a reminder that people with the virus can become unwell very quickly.
Some people don't think it's as bad as it actually is. So, you know, they won't be expecting that this is going to kill me, so therefore I'll just do what I normally do and I'll be fine. But actually, the illness can appear quite mild until you get into trouble. And when you're in trouble, you're in trouble. So it's a tricky illness to deal with.
In a statement, Te Whatu Ora says there are 54 care hubs that look after people isolating at home with COVID. Those with complex needs are identified through a survey sent by text or through a phone call, and GPs proactively call those who are at a higher risk of getting very sick. The health agency did not respond to RNZ's questions about whether it was investigating any deaths of COVID patients at home.
That from our investigative journalist, Anusha Bradley.
Well, Sport and Recreation Minister Grant Robertson told Morning Report yesterday that he has concerns about a bill that would ban alcohol sponsorship for sports and sports venues, as well as advertising during broadcasts. Now, it comes as many grassroots sports are struggling for cash, particularly during the COVID-19 pandemic. Green MP Chloe Schwarbrick submitted the Alcohol Harm Minimisation Members Bill. It's been drawn and joins us now. Good morning. Let's start first, because there's a two parts to this. So let's start first with the alcohol sponsorship issue. Grant Robertson yesterday saying he had issues with that part of it. He didn't think the money could be made up by the government if you took away that sponsorship. What's your response to that?
My response to that is that in 2014 we had a quantification of all of the money spent across all sports advertising and sponsorship. So this is not just for broadcast. Broadcast, importantly, is the part that my bill targets, but for all, including grassroots sporting. So to that effect, I've heard and I've spoken to those in the alcohol sector and those in the sporting sector and asked them for the most up-to-date figures on that. Neither have been able to give them to me, but what they've said is that it's probably substantially less than it was in 2014. So that's the first thing, is that we're looking at less than the $20 million that it was in 2014, but we're also looking at only a proportion of that, given that this is targeting broadcast sports. Now, I've also put it to the Minister in written questions to try and get him to actually quantify the amount of money that he thinks that he's talking about. But again, to put this in the context of government spending and the tune of billions and billions of dollars for a substance, that being alcohol as a drug, which contributes towards, based on Law Commission reports estimations, between $735 million to $16.1 billion of harm per annum. This is a drop in the bucket. Mm.
So are you proposing that there be like a equivalent of a smoke-free New Zealand established by the government, which would then fund those, you know, the small sports clubs? And we're not just talking about the All Blacks here with Steinlager, which is, who knows how much that is, but we're talking about a small cricket club or a rugby club or whatever that needs a booze sponsorship.
Yeah, so it's really important, Corinne, to again really make the point that this is about broadcast sports. So to that effect, we know that there's been a trajectory of decline in terms of, you know, we've seen a number of teams that have moved away off their own back, actually, but some of them losing that sponsorship from those alcohol companies in the first place. So there's two main ways that we could go about replacing this funding. The first could be that smoke-free kind of mechanism, which is the government fronting up, as was recommended by the 2014 Ministerial Forum. forum chaired by Sir Graham Lowe, actually recommending going far further than just broadcast sports and looking at banning advertising and sponsorship of all sports by alcohol companies. The second is actually a levy which currently exists for the government by virtue of the Health Promotion Agency, which is just levied on all of the alcohol sales across the country. So there's two mechanisms there, and it's up to the government to discern which one they would.
How much would a levy be? A few cents on each drink?
A few cents on each drink. For a can of beer, it'd be about 2 cents. 2 cents on an RTD, 5 cents on a bottle of wine, or 6 cents on a bottle.
It doesn't sound like much, but let's be honest here. Politicians in the past in New Zealand have shown, unless you go back a few hundred years, have shown a great reluctance to engage in clamping down on alcohol sales. So they fear that somehow there is going to be a political backlash, and you have to wonder whether that will happen again.
And this is utterly mind-blowing. We had a 2019-2020 Health Promotion Agency survey which showed that 62% of New Zealanders support banning alcohol sponsorship at sporting, community and other events that under 18-year-olds go to. So this is supported by the public that's out there. This bill in particular has the most support, I think, that any member's bill in front of our parliament has ever had prior to getting to first reading. So we've got councils from across the country who've endorsed it. We've also got Hape Te Hauora, the Health Coalition Aotearoa, St John's, the Salvation Army, Mental Health Foundation. We've got the Women's Refuge, Plunkett, Alzheimer's New Zealand, the Child Poverty Action Group.
Doesn't sound like you've got the Deputy Prime Minister, though, does it?
But this is perhaps my point. I am frustrated, and I think that this is indicative of why the New Zealand public get frustrated at politics. We have health agencies, we have overwhelming evidence, we even have two reports that the government commissioned in the last term of Parliament, which said get on with these recommendations from 2014 and from 2010 and 2011, which has subsequently been ignored by this bogeyman of the alcohol industry. So frankly, I think it's time for those who are talking about their concerns in a rather ambiguous way to front up and be absolutely crystal clear.
Let me ask you this, will this be a conscience vote?
So that's an option which is obviously currently being discussed, but I mean, I think this comes back to why I've decided to go with the two things in the bill that I have. The first is restoring local democracy with the local alcohol policies process, and the second is obviously around the alcohol advertising and sponsorship. Historically, we have seen that alcohol bills have been treated as a conscience issue, but this one has such overwhelming evidence and does not deal with pricing, nor does it deal with age. So to that effect, there's every chance that we could just treat it as a party vote.
Would you carve it? I mean, if you sort of did the rounds and you worked out maybe you've already done this, that you're not going to get the numbers to get it through on a conscience vote, with the two parts, would you consider carving the sponsorship element off to get the other bit through, which, as you say, is well supported by councils?
So you can't do that prior to the first reading. So the bill's already been drawn from the ballot, so it is what it is. And I guess that's the point that I'd make to Minister Robertson. If he supports the LAP process, then he needs to support it at first reading. And if he has those questions and serious concerns about the transition for the sports advertising and sponsorship, not the principle of making sure that we move away from that reliance of broadcast alcohol advertising, then let's deal with that at Select Committee. All of these issues can be overcome if politicians have the wherewithal and the backbone to stand on their principles and get this through to Select Committee.
Chloe Schwarbrick, thank you very much for your time, Green Party MP.
And we finished this morning with a heroic feat of Lego engineering. The Guinness World Records has verified that Auckland teenager Alex Blong holds the new record for building the most carriages on a toy train that moves. Now, Blong sent his 25-metre train 10 metres down a track at Britomart Station. It's comprised of 6 electric engines and 101 carriages. It's taken a while for this record to be verified, but the 14-year-old got the good news in the mail yesterday, and this morning joins us on the line. Kia ora, good morning to you, Alex.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm well, thanks. You must be pretty stoked at this.
Oh, I am. I'm very stoked about it. It's a fantastic achievement that it feels surreal. Like, it's a Guinness World Record. It's something.
It's not bad, is it, at 14?
Pardon?
It's not bad at 14, is it?
Yeah, no, it's not bad at all.
Now, I've just been watching some footage of this. You did it at Britomart Station, right?
Yep, that is correct.
And how long did it take you to put this together?
It took me about 100 hours in total to, like, build the carriage and locomotives.
And why did you want to do it?
So So essentially, I was inspired by this TV show where there was like a really, really long train. And obviously, during lockdown, people got quite bored. So I got bored and I decided that I'd build this really long train. And I decided to also check if there's like a Guinness World Record, because that would certify it a long train. And then I realized that there was actually a record. So I was like, oh, I think this is relatively achievable. And that's basically what set me on the path to achieve this Guinness World Record.
Yeah. So yours was 101 carriages long. What was the record you had to break?
The previous record was 69 carriages.
So you weren't content at 70?
No, I felt that if I wanted to break the record, I wanted to obviously go a bit higher so that the next person doing it would then have to do quite a bit more as well. So it was a safety net. And it was also, I thought the number 101 was quite a cool number.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Have you been a Lego freak for quite a while?
Yeah, I've obviously grown up with Lego. I think at the age of 3, I got my first Lego set, and it's really stuck with me throughout my years, and I don't plan on, I guess, giving it up anytime soon.
Hey, Alex, how did you fund this?
Okay, so I have this streaming service where what I do is I open Pokemon cards for people on Facebook, and basically I used a lot of the money from that to purchase the Lego and build the carriages.
Wow, so you did that?
Obviously.
Yeah, you did that yourself. How much did that cost you?
So in total, I probably spent around $8,000 on the train.
Wow, $8,000.
Yeah, it's something.
But it's worth it. What did you get from Guinness? The Guinness World Records, did they send you a tohu or a gong of some sort? Like a prize,
so
you know? Like
all you really get from them is you get obviously the website that says you've done this, and then you get like a really cool certificate, and that's really it.
That's pretty cool. Hey, what's your next, are you done with the Lego? What's your next challenge?
So basically, my next project is not a Guinness World Record. I'm just building like a Lego spiral for trains to go down and then like a return for them to go up like a Lego mountain. So it's not as big a project, but it's something fun I thought I'd do.
Yeah, awesome. Hey, thanks very much for talking with us this morning and congratulations on your Guinness World Record. That's Alex Blong, who's the world record holder after building 6 electric engines and 101 carriages and firing it off 10 metres down a track at Britomart Station.
You've been listening to Morning Report Top Stories from RadioNZ.co.nz.